Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we are live in the Allstate Skyline studio here on a Monday morning, and that means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time. We're going to talk about the happiest states in the country, and we got some Emmy facts. Tonight are the Emmys. They will be handed out tonight. Michael Che and Colin Jost are the hosts, and so we're looking forward to that. And then tomorrow morning, Dan Feinberg is going to join us to talk about the results, the winners, the losers, all that cool stuff of the Emmys. So that's all coming up. And as you know, it is Monday morning, and that means that we do the Monday morning movie reviews with Eric Childress and Colin Suter. And also, Eric's going to stick around, and we're going to get a final wrap-up of the Toronto Film Festival that he got back from. So a ton of movies, and we'll talk about those, what he saw, what he liked, and all that cool stuff. Well, lots of movies to talk about this for this weekend, so let's get the guys here. Here's Eric. Hello, Eric.
Hello.
And Colin. Welcome, Colin.
Thank you. Hello.
All right. So let's see. Let's start out with Eric. Why don't you tell everybody about The Predator?
Okay. Well, this is the updated version of The Predator. Basically, a sequel, continuing the line that began in 1987. This time with Shane Black taking on directorial duties and also co-writing duties with his Monster Squad partner Fred Decker.
I gotta say, Eric, when I saw that credit, I almost cheered.
It was nice, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was like Fred Decker, yeah. All right, you know.
Especially considering that they just made this Monster Squad documentary, and you just kind of feel bad for Fred Decker after that thing. So it was kind of nice that Shane Black reached out. I mean, you know, he reached out to a couple people that from his past, and one of them didn't turn out so well.
Yeah, one of them didn't.
We'll get into that maybe in a minute, but. Another military group led by Boyd Holbrook is in the in the jungle trying to get some hostages, and they come across another predator. Holbrook forgets some of the predator's things, and worried that there might be a cover up on the horizon. He mails a bunch of the stuff to his own P.O. box, but instead it goes over to his son and his wife, his son played by the fantastic Jacob Tremblay, who has some development issues, but he's very good with video games and electronics, and he toys around with the Predator stuff, and it basically signals another Predator from outer space to come down and retrieve these things that they were on the hunt for from a predator who stole it from them. Boyd Holbrook gets thrown in military jail, and that leads him into basically another group of inmates, including Keegan-Michael Key, Thomas Jane, Trevante Rhodes, a real kind of ragtag group of guys. And Olivia Munn plays a scientist who specializes in extraterrestrial stuff. Shirley K. Brown basically plays the jerky government guy that is, trying to, get all the predator technology for the government. And it just basically leads to a lot of showdowns between humans and predators. And that's exactly what you should expect out of this movie. And for a movie written and directed by Shane Black, if you go in expecting anything but a Shane Black movie, you'd probably be disappointed. The only serious Shane Black effort that I was not a big fan of was Iron Man 3, and that just didn't feel like it had his voice behind it. Downey brought him in for that, but it just felt like other than those couple of twists that happened during that movie, it didn't really feel like a Shane Black movie. This one to me did, and I just to me it was just basically like watching the A-Team take on the Predator, and I was kind of okay with that. Boyd Holbrook is not exactly, it wouldn't be my choice for a leading man, but he has a lot of help in that group of guys that he surrounds himself with. I had fun hanging with this crew in the same way that you had kind of fun hanging with those tough guys back in 1987. These guys are a little looser They're a lot more fun to be around. They're a little less serious. And it leads to some fantastic gore. It leads to, a third act that has been reshot and recut, and a few things are a little clunky down there, but it leads to a lot of carnage. And you know, that's exactly what I wanted out of this movie. And I think that, this is kind of a perfect study example of, you know, what you need from a movie when you need it. And I mean, I saw this at the midnight premiere at Toronto after I saw, movies by Asghar Farhadi and, a really heavy Maggie Gyllenhaal film. So this is exactly what I needed at the end of that night. Now, unfortunately, right before that happened, this scandal happened with, the casting of the movie, and Fox didn't exactly handle that well, and a lot of critics saw the movie after that, and I'm kind of curious how many of them had the reviews affected by this knowledge that they all of a sudden wasn't as much fun as it could have been. But I had fun. I'm recommending it. It's my second favorite Predator movie. It's not a huge recommendation, but it's one nevertheless.
Yeah, I liked it too. I thought it was a lot of fun and and really goofy. And it didn't take itself seriously at all. And the whole ragtag group of criminal guys who break out of the sky. I mean, how many different vehicles do they have that they use in this movie? At one point, inexplicably, they're in a Winnebago. I'm like, what is going on? The camaraderie between all the guys, especially Thomas Jane and Keegan-Michael Key.
Yes.
They're great and very, very funny in it. And the effects are fun. There's a lot of good gore. I'm glad it's an R-rated Predator movie, not a PG-13 Predator movie. Everybody seems to just be in the same. Everybody seems to be on the same wavelength. I think Shane Black, established the tone very early on. And even Jacob Tremblay has a good time in this movie. Like, he's,
Certainly.
And Olivia Munn really gets to kick some ass in this movie. She's terrific in it, man. I also really, really love the casting of Jake Busey. Kind of a throwback to Predator 2. Where his dad was, and I was hoping he would be related to him in that character.
Yeah, me too.
And Sterling K. Brown is great. He's got all the, and just munching on Nicorette gum throughout the entire movie. Boyd Holbrook is probably the only sort of like not, he just seems, because he's just this really good looking guy who's not the most terrific actor in the world. Is he related?
Right.
Is he related to Hal Holbrook?
I believe so.
That's his son?
I think so.
Yeah, because I don't know a lot of Holbrooks.
Yeah.
That's why.
Or grandson, maybe.
Or grandson. Yeah, it could be grandson. Yeah. But anyway, I thought it was fun, and it's really goofy. The audience I saw it with had a really good time. Lots of laughs. People seem to have a really good time all the way through. So I'm recommending it too. I think The Predator is a very, very entertaining, goofy movie. So there you go. All right, Colin, why don't you tell us about White Boy Rick?
All right, well, this is based on a true story, and it's about a teenager named, and it takes place in the 80s, a teenager named Rick Wersha, Jr., played by Richie Merritt, and he's a high school dropout who lives with his father, played by Matthew McConaughey, and his sister, played by Bella Pauly, and, they live in, to say the least, a less than ideal home life. Rick's dad sells guns out of his car. His sister is strung out on drugs. And Rick himself is a street hustler in his own right. And their lives are about to be watched ever more closely by the feds and the drug enforcement agencies who are watching them. And in fact, Rick ends up being their informant and someone who will wear a wire in certain situations, and it's a tough spot for him to be in. The agents, I should say, are played by Jennifer Jason Leigh and Rory Cochrane. And is that meta casting to cast him as a drug enforcement agent for Dazed and Confused? It's no spoiler when I say that eventually Rick becomes a drug kingpin, because it's right there on the poster. It says everything that he became before he turned 16. And so this is, you know, one of these movies that, you know, kind of movies that we've seen a lot of lately, like American Animals and War Dogs and things like that, where, you know, it's a crazy story based on a true story, but, you know, involving guns and drugs and lots of money and young people who don't know what they're doing and all that.
Okay, hang on, Colin, hang on.
Okay.
Hang on one second. We're going to take a break and we'll come back. We know what the movie's about now. We're going to hear what Colin thinks of it, and then we'll find out what I thought of it and what Eric thought of it. That's White Boy Rick coming up right after the news on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. And we are live in the Allstate Skyline studio here until 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich will have the opening bell at 5. Steve Cochran at 6 for your morning drive. It is Monday morning. My dad's going to call in and tell a joke. We're going to talk about the Emmys, and we're going to talk about the happiest states ranked, and much more. Our phone number is 312-981-7200 for talk and text, and you can follow us on Twitter at Nick D Show. And the best way to stay connected is on our Facebook page at facebook.com/Nick D Show. Monday morning also means Monday morning movie reviews with Eric Childress and Colin Suter. And we will also get a wrap up of the Toronto Film Festival as well that Eric just got back from. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Colin, welcome back.
Thank you.
All right, Colin told us about the plot to White Boy Rick, which is the new Matthew McConaughey film, before the break.
Okay, before I do, by the way, I just looked at Boyd Holbrook's IMDb page, and it doesn't say anything about him being related to Hal Holbrook.
Oh, okay. So, all right.
Yeah.
I just don't think
he certainly doesn't look like Hal.
I don't know any other person named Holbrook than Hal Holbrook. That's why I thought, well, he must be related, but okay. All right.
All right, so White Boy Rick. My problem with this movie happened pretty early on, in that I felt like I was dropped into the middle of it. It doesn't really give much in the way of context for Rick's life and how he got the way, you know, how he turned out the way he did. I mean, of course, you look at his father, and there's some obvious things going on there, but Rick is pretty much already, you know, kind of just destined for, you know, what's going to happen to him. And so there's not much of an arc here, or at least, you know, one that the audience can sort of get a hold of, you know, get a grasp on for the story and to really care about this kid. He's not a very interesting or likable character. I'd maybe rather see a movie just about his father than about him, you know, because I think Matthew McConaughey, his scenes with McConaughey, I think, are the best ones in the film, because McConaughey's presence adds something to these scenes that I think make it interesting. But when it's just the kid, when it's just Richie Merritt, I kind of found myself tuning out a little bit. Like, I just did not care about this kid when it was over, and they, you know, they say what happened to him and how, you know, what his life eventually became. I was like, yeah, I kind of figured that was going to happen. So what? Which is a bad thing for a movie that's based on a true story, especially one like this. There might be a good film or a good film to be made out of this story, but this one just made me, I just felt kind of cast adrift from it, because I think it's missing some important details, some important context to make us really care about what happens to this character. You know, to its credit, it's not, you know, it's not the usual one of these movies, which is filled with a lot of period piece needle drops to propel it, to make it, you know, a Goodfellas wannabe. It's not that kind of film. and I think Belle Powley is also pretty good in it. So, I mean, there's good performances in here. It's just, I just didn't care at all about the central character. And I feel like his story, you know, it's the big selling point of the story is that all this stuff happened to him before he was the age of 16. Well, I'm sure if you go to the south side of Chicago, you'll probably find somebody else with that same kind of story, at least a few people with that same kind of story. And, you know, so doesn't feel that compelling to me. So I'm giving this a big fat pass on it.
Okay. So. Eric?
Yeah, Colin just hit on something that I'm going to circle back on, because my biggest problem with this movie is where it ultimately just kind of ends up. You know, throughout the course of the movie, the filmmaker, Jan Demange, and the screenwriters don't seem to know exactly where they're taking us. And there's a, you know, for a couple moments I was kind of glad that it wasn't like Colin said, it wasn't just, you know, the way that the movie's actually being advertised as this kind of like, you know, the, you know, rise to riches through the, you know, the crime syndicate that, you know, this kid, you know, was going to go through, was going to get like a Scarface kind of thing for a 15-year-old. I'm glad it wasn't quite going that direction, but it's so confusing. It's kind of weaving and bobbing through all these different storylines that the sort of the key thing about the movie that this kid was an informant for the FBI and the Drug Enforcement Agency is kind of lost throughout the way. And, you know, there even ads that have these testimonials from like real life investigators, and it's not like until late in the movie that you're supposed to, you know, gather that the government's not supposed to be doing this. And I'm like, oh well, that would have been an interesting way to frame the story, that, you know, this kid was being used by the government and then, you know, thrown into this really horrific life, and then they take no responsibility for it. But by the time you get around to that, you're just like, so what? And then at the very end, when, again, they make this point about what happened to this kid and the kind of the martyr treatment that they want to give this kid, I almost flicked off the screen. I was just like, wait a second. Like, to have a movie called literally, I mean, I know this is his nickname, White Boy Rick, and to, you know, to make him the martyr when Colin mentioned that there's so many other people that have probably had this story happen to them, maybe without the FBI or the DEA interference in their lives, but that they live this thing out every day, and a lot of people that have gone to jail for nonviolent drug offenses, and this kid, you know, we're supposed to feel sorry because he's done it the longest. No, I'm sorry that you don't get off that easily. And with the exception of McConaughey, who I think is really good in the movie, I think that, you know, he hits some great comedic beats during the movie. And I think, you know, even when the movie is weaving through these dramatic elements that don't quite fit together, I think he's, you know, strings it all together. And I'll watch anything that, you know, gives me a couple scenes with Brian Tyree Henry in it. But other than that, you know, again, this is probably even a bigger pass for me than it was for Colin.
Yeah, no, this is not good. I was really disappointed in this movie. I was looking forward to it. McConaughey does not disappoint. He's the best thing in the movie. There's just no question about it. He, you know, he's great, and you can tell that this is this kid's first. He's not an actor. This kid's not an actor, and you can tell. I mean, that's like very
bad,
very apparent that he can't. He's not an actor, he had kind of a, in his real life, he had kind of a rough go of it, and he was he was into crimes and stuff like that, and that's how he got the part. But they should have picked an actor, basically. But yeah, the screenplay's all over the place. I didn't care about what was happening. The only time for me when the movie came to life was when McConaughey was on screen. And the rest of it is very confused. And morally, it's like you said, Eric, it just, you know, what we're supposed to feel at the end of this movie, the movie doesn't earn it at all. So I was real disappointed with this movie, and I'm not recommending it, despite the fact that, you know, I think McConaughey is very good in it. But this is a really interesting story that has a lot of potential, but they blow it. I mean, they really blow it with this one. So I'm saying no to White Boy Rick. So, all right. Eric, tell us about Mandy.
Okay. Let's see. I'll keep this pretty simple on the plot explanation. Basically, Nicolas Cage and Andrea Riseborough play husband and wife who are on, a camping trip. And they just happen to be in the same neck of the woods as a really crazy religious cult. Needless to say, their paths intersect when his wife, Aunt Riseborough's character, is kidnapped. And are they going to brainwash her? Are they going to do something worse to her? Let's just say the things do not turn out particularly well. And that leads Cage's character spiraling into a madcap whirlwind of colorful revenge.
Yeah.
Okay. Is that enough of a plot for everyone? I think that's good, right?
That's
okay.
Good.
Again, you start, you know, with that kind of, you know, plot description. Maybe not a religious cult, but, you know, we've seen revenge films, you know, countless times. We just had one last week that you guys reviewed called Peppermint. This one was premiered at the Sundance Film Festival this year, which I did not see then. I saw it more than a few weeks ago. But it was kind of the toast of the town at Sundance amongst the Midnight fans. And, you know, all you heard, you know, throughout town after this movie premiered was Nicolas Cage chainsaw fight.
Yep.
That was, you know, and colored me, in, you know, intrigued by that. What I was less intrigued about, and the reason I didn't go see this movie at Sundance, is because the director of the film, Panos Cosmatos, directed a film many years ago called Beyond the Black Rainbow that I found very tedious, you know, kind of a gorgeous film to look at, but just a kind of a tedious, pretentious slog of a, you know, a horse, kind of a psychedelic horror film, and I wasn't really up for, you know, that at a midnight showing in the cold of Park City. Having seen this movie on, you know, basically a screener link on my television at home, I can appreciate that there are people that really enjoy, you know, looking at this movie. I mean, if people are, you know, going to this thing thinking that they're going to be getting a madcap whirlwind of revenge for, you know, a good 2 hours, they need to strap in for something, you know, really completely different in many ways. And that's really sort of my biggest problem with this film, is that this movie runs over 2 hours long. To me, there's probably a really great classic in there somewhere between 80 and 90 minutes, because as gorgeous as this movie can be at times, I mean, the cinematography of this thing is off the charts, and it seems that so much time is being spent, you know, setting up these gorgeous shots and lighting them and coloring them in such a certain way that, as far as the momentous drive of this movie, it's not there. And I got tired of waiting for setups and all the staring that goes on. And, you know, as crazy as the religious cult can be, I mean, it's just, I mean, everyone talks so slowly, and there's a lot of more staring. They stare at the camera, they stare at each other, and then there's more red and pink and all this kind of stuff. And then, of course, you get Nicolas Cage screaming and downing vodka and chainsaw fights and, you know, smashing heads and all these kind of things. And that's all great and all, but there are a lot of fits and starts in between all that stuff as well. And, you know, when Colin and I have, you know, talked lesser of the latest film from Nicholas Winding Refn, you know, that's kind of what it feels like. You know, you have a director who's completely in charge of the visual narrative, but not really in charge of the forward narrative that's there. So I can appreciate that people really see something in this movie, because it's unlike most movies you're going to see. But as something I'm going to watch again, I want to see a much shorter cut of this movie.
Okay. All right. Hang on, guys, okay? Eric and Colin are going to hang on here. When we come back, we'll find out what Colin thought of Mandy, the new Nicolas Cage movie, and I'll tell you what I thought of it as well. And that's coming up right after we take this break on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate Skyline studio. It's Monday morning. My dad's going to call and tell a joke. We're in the middle of the Monday morning movie reviews, and Eric Childress is going to stick around and give us his second report on the films that he saw at the Toronto Film Festival, where he just got back. And then at 5 o'clock, you've got Steve Grzanich with the opening bell. 6 o'clock is the great Steve Cochran. And coming up, the stories that matter with Vic Vaughn from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom on WGN Radio. But let's get back to the movie reviews. Before the break, Eric described and told us what he thought of the new movie Mandy. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Colin, welcome back.
Thank you.
All right. Colin, what do you think?
Well, all I can say is thank God. I thought I was going to be the only one of the three of us, because I really wasn't on board with this either. I pretty much echo everything Eric said. This got to be a really beautiful but tedious exercise in, you know, exploitation cinema, I guess what you call it. But I mean, it's you know, it's another bloody revenge film, and I just saw one of those, like Eric said, like last week. I didn't really need to see this story played out again. Granted, this is a much different film than Peppermint, much different from anything else that's out there, and like Eric, I appreciate that. But you know, this is just one of those things. Either it's your thing or it's not. And I just found that it wasn't, aside from a few moments. I think this definitely could be pared down to, you know, an 85 or 90 minute movie, and with all the Nicolas Cage craziness going on, I think that would be delightful. But there's just a lot of kind of self-indulgence going on here that I just wasn't really interested in. I didn't see this guy's last film, the Beyond the Black Rainbow, and nor am I really very interested in seeing it. And I know that the Refn's name keeps getting brought up between, you know, here and on some discussions that I've seen online, and like I think he would watch this and go, dude, tone it down a little bit. This is a little, you know, let's let the story get in here once in a while. This was kind of a disappointment for me, especially based on all the advanced word of mouth that I was hearing that this was Nicolas Cage's return to form, and it is, but it's lost among in all this other stuff that is not nearly as interesting. So yeah, I'm glad people are having a good time with it. There's a lot of stuff here to enjoy, but for me personally, it's just not my thing.
Yeah, well, it's my thing. I loved it. I thought it was great. I was with it the whole time, man, and I know it takes forever to get to the crazy payoff, but that stuff is so beautifully shot, and so, I mean, I love the score. I thought all the acting was really, really interesting and weird, and I was just, this movie did have a hypnotic effect on me. I mean, the pacing was slow, there's no question about it, very slowly paced movie, but it had an effect, like a put a spell on me while I watched it. And by the time all the insanity hits, and this is a crazy movie, this movie is absolutely crazy. By the time, you know, the Cage insanity hits and the chainsaw fights are happening and all that stuff, I was on board 100%. And I think it's because, you know, the table was set perfectly for me. I thought the payoff was huge. I laughed a lot during the movie at inappropriate moments. I thought Linus Roach was fantastic as the Charles Manson type cult leader, and I thought all of his minions, they looked like they were Cenobites. He's hanging out with, I didn't know what the hell was going on, and it's got a very distinct crazy look to it now. And if I'm not mistaken, his dad is George P. Cosmatos, the director.
It's actually Hal Holbrook.
Okay, there we go. No, but this is confirmed. This is for real. He is George Cosmatos' son. He's a completely different kind of filmmaker than his dad was. So
yeah, he actually did Second Unit on Tombstone, so that'd be a wild coincidence.
Okay. But anyway, so I think this is, I had not seen the other movie, I liked, but I really loved what I saw here, and I thought it was hypnotic and weird and crazy, and it does have some vintage Cage in it, and I think the whole thing pays off. So I'm a really big fan of this movie. I think it's crazy and great.
I would say, I mean, it is, I think it, a movie like this, it kind of does matter how you watch it, when you watch it, and it is playing at the Music Box.
Yeah.
And just for sheer visuals, I would recommend seeing it on the big screen instead of seeing it, on demand, which you can. But you know, maybe that's the thing. Maybe just need to watch it on a big screen in a theater and to be ready for it. So
yeah, I watched it in my living room. So
you didn't fall asleep in the theater as easily.
I didn't fall asleep. I watched it very late on Friday night, and I was mesmerized by it. So I thought it was great. So anyway, that's Mandy. All right, so let's see. Colin, why don't you tell us about A Simple Favor?
All right, well, this is the latest from director Paul Feig, director of Bridesmaids and the Ghostbusters from a couple years ago. And it's about a single suburban mom of a six-year-old. The mom is Anna Kendrick, and she's the kind of woman who is constantly volunteering for stuff at her kid's school and making the other parents look bad. And just kind of an overachiever in their eyes. And anyway, her son has made friends with another kid, and they want a play date together. Well, that kid's mom is the exact opposite of Kendrick's character in every way. And she's played by Blake Lively, and she has a very dark sense of humor. She's pretty outspoken, and she'll always have the upper hand in every conversation and tells it like it is, no matter how uncomfortable it is. She's that kind of person. And while the kids have their play date, these two moms end up becoming friends over several dry martinis in the afternoons. And Lively's character is married to a once-famous writer played by Henry Golding, who's in also in Crazy Rich Asians right now. And things get complicated when she asks Kendrick to watch her kid for a day while she leaves her business trip. Then things get a little complicated, and probably the less I say, the better. So this is, like I said, from Paul Feig, who has made quite a name for himself as a male director who has made, some of the funniest and most successful female-based comedies of the last several years.
Colin, hang on.
Yeah.
All right, we're going to take a break. And that's the summary of what the movie's about. And then when we come back, we'll hear what Colin thought of Simple Favor, what Eric thought of it, what I thought of it, and then we will talk about Toronto Film Festival as well. So we'll take a quick break here on 720 WGN, and we'll be back after the news. Hey, welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate Skyline Studios, 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago. We're here till 5 o'clock. Steve Grzanich has the opening bell at 5, Steve Cochran at 6 for your morning drive. It is Monday morning. That means my dad's going to call and tell a joke. We are going to talk about the Emmys. We've got some facts about the Emmys, past and present. And the Emmys will be handed out tonight, later on. And we'll cover that again tomorrow with Dan Feinberg, all the results and everything. That's all coming up. Our phone number is 312-981-7200 for talk and text. Before the break, Colin told us the plot of A Simple Favor, the new Anna Kendrick, Blake Lively movie directed by Paul Feig. And let's get everybody back. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Colin, welcome back.
Thank you.
All right, Colin, continue. A Simple Favor.
Yeah, so as I was saying, Feig has been making a name for himself as a male director who's behind many of the most successful female-based comedies of the last several years. And that's because, he knows how to get, he knows how to work with them and get, the best and funniest performances out of them. You know, this could have easily been another sort of Melissa McCarthy vehicle or, Kate McKinnon vehicle or, pair those two actresses like that together, two comedic actresses like that together. Here, he seems more interested in making a real movie with real characters who are not just kind of improvising and being loose with it, but they're really he's more interested in getting a really good story here, in not going for big laughs. This is a comedy, but it's not going for big laughs. If something is really funny, it's probably has more of something to do with how Kendrick or Lively are delivering the line more than the line itself. And I think that he's taking a really, interesting turn stylistically with this film, just by virtue of the fact that of how he cast it and how it's being executed and the tone of it. It's a really interesting, movie, just based on how it's presented. I mean, it is a mystery. It is a kind of like a page turner kind of mystery, or a Gone Girl type thing, done in a much lighter way than we've seen before, because Anna Kendrick just has that kind of lively, lighthearted personality at the center of this thing. And then you pair her up with Blake Lively, who's just, cold as ice. And it makes for a really interesting dynamic. And you kind of, I was buying into what the friendship that was evolving between them. And I wasn't as invested in the mystery behind what was happening so much as I was invested in the characters themselves who are trying to solve it. And that's not a criticism, but more of a compliment than anything. Well, I really enjoyed this movie. I mean, I think it's funny, but it's also just a really interesting turn from Paul Feig, who, you know, could have easily made just another improv comedy with outrageous gags in it. But he went the other way, and I think it's all the better for it.
Okay. All right, Eric?
I like this movie a whole lot. This is one of the real genuine surprises of the year for me. Obviously I haven't read the book, but from what I get the sense is that the book is more in the lines of, you know, the kind of the typical page turners along the lines of like Gone Girl or The Girl on the Train. These mysteries involving women, being taken out of their comfort zones and things like that, and dealing with some different issues of marriage and stuff like that. But Paul Feig seems to be, not necessarily doing a spoof of, that type of movie, but he is having fun with that type of potboiler. And he has Anna Kendrick at the center of this movie giving one of my favorite performances of the year. Both Kendrick and Lively give two of the most subtle physical comedic performances that I've seen in some time, and that you just get the sense that every part of Kendrick's body is this, like a goosebump that is just wanting to just jump off her body and just to do something, and at the same time needs to retreat when, things start to, really hit the fan for her. And then Blake Lively is, she's like this supermodel on pause, and the line readings that they have together are just so rich and wonderful and really funny. I mean, Colin's right that, this is not Bridesmaids or Spy. This is not that type of comedy, and yet there are huge laughs in this movie just based on the behavior of the characters. Particularly, Anna Kendrick just rules in this movie. Just everything she does made me smile or laugh out loud. And I think that might confuse people who might, do invest themselves a little bit more in the mystery. I think the only time this movie, takes a slight off step is when it actually has to kind of sink its teeth into the sort of the investigation of what exactly is going on in the story, and that happened about well into an hour into the movie, but it doesn't detract too much from it, because it leads to a climax that again I think is kind of goofing on those type of outrageous twist filled climaxes that we've seen time and time again. And it just, again, it all just kind of comes back to these two lead performances that I think are both so wonderful. I hope people know going in that this is a comedy, because if they don't, the way the movie is kind of being advertised, they may be confused the way my audience was. I mean, I only had an audience of maybe about 30, 40 people tops, but I was laughing louder than any of them throughout the movie, particularly in the reference to one particular French movie that gets brought up during the film, that I don't think any of them, like, what is that?
I was the only person who laughed out loud.
Me too.
Yep.
Me too. And so I had so much fun watching this movie that it's the kind of movie that I really wanted to go out and, tell people, like, you have to see this movie. Trust me on this. You are going to enjoy it. It's my favorite film of the week.
It's terrific. It's really, really entertaining and really funny. Like you said, Eric, I laughed out loud a lot. There were only a couple of other people who laughed with me. We were in the minority. But man, and Anna Kendrick is hilarious in this movie. And the whole subplot with the jealous moms is fantastic. And which is cast by the Feig stalwarts are all like the moms and dads, the single moms and dads, which has a huge payoff at the end. But I think Blake Lively's really great in this movie. Having been a fan of Blake Lively just on because of Gossip Girl, she hasn't really had a chance to have a part like this. You know what I mean? Like this is a great part for her. because she gets to do her comedy chops as well, and it's a subtle performance, and it's a really good performance, and the friendship between the two women is the core of the movie. And yeah, I think it gets a little long in the tooth towards the end when, you know, you're traveling from here to here to check out this hotel, and, you know, what's the mystery here? I wasn't as invested in the mystery as I was in just the characters themselves, as you said, Eric. But that doesn't mean it's not satisfying, because it is. It's just there's a little stretch in the movie where it just seemed that Anna Kendrick in a car going to a motel, you know, sneaking around and asking questions and stuff like that. That got a little bit repetitive late in the film. But then again, something comes back and there's a huge payoff as well. I was all over this movie, and I thought it was incredibly entertaining and very, very funny, and a nice change of pace for Paul Feig, and, you know, who proves with this that he can change up the style really nicely. It seemed to me like it was like Paul Feig doing like an R-rated Lifetime movie. And that's what it seemed like, you know, and I think that's exactly what he was going for. I think that's the tone he was shooting for, was like R-rated funny version of a Lifetime movie with two central performances that are just hilarious and great. So, yeah, no, this is a really, really entertaining movie, like a very, very entertaining film that I think it's the best movie of the week. So, all right. Well, there it is. Yeah, and it did okay. Well,
I think it did pretty. I mean, I wasn't expecting it to do that much, actually.
Yeah.
So I think it's a pretty solid number, and I think if the word of mouth can take effect, it might translate into something. We'll see next week. Yeah. I mean, if it drops below like 8 million, then, you know, it's DOA.
Yeah. Well, I hope people go and see it, because it's a really terrific movie. So
yeah.
All right. Next week we've got the Michael Moore documentary Fahrenheit 11/9. We also have Eli Roth's family movie.
Yeah.
The house with a clock in its walls. And then Life Itself, which is not the, obviously not the Roger Ebert documentary.
No.
And then Love, Gilda, which is a documentary about Gilda Radner, which I'm very excited to see.
Right.
So, all right. Colin, thank you, sir. We will talk to you next week.
Sounds good.
Okay, buddy. There's Colin. And Eric, you stick around.
Okay.
When we come back, pick out some movies that you want to talk about from the Toronto Film Festival, okay?
Okay.
All right. Eric Childress is going to hang out with us. We'll take a quick break when we come back. More about the Toronto Film Festival coming up right after this. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we are live in the Allstate Skyline Studios. We just finished the Monday morning movie reviews, and Eric Childress is sticking around because he just got back from Toronto. We had a report last week live from Toronto with a whole bunch of movie reviews, and now we've got Eric back, and we want to talk about more of them. All right, Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
All right, where do you want to start?
Well, I mean, I think we need to start with, I have a trio of films from Oscar-winning filmmakers that are probably all going to play some role somewhere in this year's awards race.
Okay.
Okay, and considering that last week when I was at the film festival and I started off with talking about Damien Chazelle's First Man,
yeah.
Maybe it's only appropriate that we now talk about Barry Jenkins' new movie, If Beale Street Could Talk. And this is a film based on a James Baldwin novel. Stars Stefan James as a young man. It's like set in the 1950s or 60s, and he's, you know, in love with basically his childhood sweetheart. But as the film opens, we discover that he has been sent to jail, and she is pregnant. So the film kind of plays this, kind of has this kind of this episodic but dreamlike feel as it sort of takes us through exactly why he's in jail, breaking the news of the pregnancy to both of the families, finding out exactly how, you know, these lives are going to proceed if they're going to be kept apart through all this time. Barry Jenkins has only made, you know, obviously he's used the director of Moonlight, did a film before that called Medicine for Melancholy. And, this is, you know, people say, like, you know, it's like, well, this kind of proves that Moonlight was no fluke. And Barry Jenkins, you know, really has it. You know, James Baldwin's work has been, you know, talked about as being kind of unadaptable in a way, because there's a very distinctive voice to James Baldwin. People want to see the documentary I Am Not Your Negro, they can get, you know, get a sense of, you know, just how, you know, prophetic James Baldwin's prose can be. But this feels like, you know, even having without having read the novel, you feel Baldwin all over this thing. It's a beautiful film to look at. The acting is really strong. It just kind of glides you through this period of racism. You know, not that there's any period doesn't have racism in it, but you know, obviously this very particular time in these young people's lives, and how, you know, simple acts can, you know, destroy lives forever, you know, for the worse. And it should be mentioned that Regina King plays the mother of the girl in the film, and she is most likely going to be nominated for Best Supporting Actress, if not win at all, frankly. So that's something to look at. That's coming out in late October. It might be expanding sometime in November, but it's a wonderful film that people should really look forward to.
Okay, that's If Beale Street Could Talk, which is Barry Jenkins' follow-up to Moonlight. Okay. All right, what's next?
Next is a little film from Alfonso Cuarón called Roma.
Yeah.
Yeah, and is there a trailer for this? Have you seen much?
Yeah.
There is a trailer for this movie. Okay, well, this is a movie that's going to be premiering on Netflix later this year, I believe in December. But this is a film that if Netflix has any sense, they will get this film out in theaters at the very least in the big cities, in a city like Chicago, with people who can, you know, really appreciate what Cuarón does with this movie. This is a semi-autobiographical tale about, loosely based on his family, told through the eyes of the family maid in the film, who is there, you know, doing all her daily chores, but it really kind of feels like a part of the family, even while the family is going through, you know, a bit of a crisis in its own existence. And then she comes upon her own crisis when she also finds herself pregnant and basically abandoned by the child's father, and having the family support her through, you know, these several months in her life. And again, this is a film that has this dreamlike quality. It's filmed in black and white, gorgeous black and white photography, and takes us, you know, this lyrical, way of looking at this family and this maid's journey through, you know, whether or not she, you know, is going to have this baby or not. And it's a film that, while I was watching it, and it was the last movie I saw at Toronto before I left, and I'm so glad that I got to see it on a really big, giant screen, because it reminded me of the types of films that I studied in film school, the kind of films that, that weren't necessarily studied for the overall narrative arc, although this film certainly does have one, but the kind of films that you would study for the images and the way that they all sort of have, you know, each image had its own meaning, and each image, you know, would later pay off into something greater, and how every image in the film amounts to the greater whole of the film's existence. It's a really beautiful piece of work that I was just thinking about all the way to the airport and beyond, and, you know, whether I see it on Netflix or Blu-ray or whatever it eventually is going to, you know, come out, I hope that people will get a chance to experience this movie in a theater, because there are some wonderful references to his own filmography and, you know, sort of inspirations that he's had over the years, particularly for Gravity, which is kind of funny in the film. It's a beautiful work of art. It's called Roma.
Yeah, I can't wait to see it, man. So, all right, yep. Eric, hang on, okay?
Mm-hmm.
All right, there you go. More about the Toronto Film Festival right here with Eric Childress when we come back right here on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. And we are live in the Allstate Skyline studio right here on Wacker in downtown Chicago. 312-981-7200 is the phone number for talk and text. Monday morning, that means my dad's going to tell a joke. As we do every Monday morning. And we did the Monday morning movie reviews, and now we're getting a follow-up. Our second report from Eric Childress, who just got back from the Toronto Film Festival, and is telling us about some of the movies he saw. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
Okay, man. Where do you want to go next?
Okay. Well, this will tail end the Oscar-winning filmmaker discussion and lead us into sort of a discussion of two films involving powerful women. And the first of those has to be Steve McQueen's Widows. Set right here in Chicago, people have seen the trailer. You know, it's a story of a group of widows who were married to basically a gang of thieves led by Liam Neeson. And as their latest job goes bad, just as the film opens, they all become widows. And that includes Viola Davis, who was married to Liam Neeson, Michelle Rodriguez, Elizabeth Debicki, and Carrie Coon. And they are the widows in question. And this is a film that, you know, it seems like this is the setup for the next Oceans movie, in a way, a much darker versions of the Oceans films. And, it has that sort of, that kind of element about it, but in a far less slicker way. These are not hardened criminals that are going to now attempt to pull off the next job on their husband's wish list, basically because their lives are and become in danger due to some really nasty politics happening in our wonderful city of Chicago that involves not just Colin Farrell and his father, played by Robert Duvall, but also the people running against him for the local alderman spot, played by Brian Tyree Henry and his brother Daniel Kaluuya from Get Out. So the cast alone should get anyone excited for this movie. But and I've been kind of an outlier with Steve McQueen's work. I'm not the biggest fan of 12 Years a Slave, Gravity Forever, I was not a big fan of Shame, and the Hunger Strike movie. I don't care about people with hunger strikes, but anyway, but this movie just really zings. It roars. It's fast paced. It's really suspenseful at times. It has this great intersection, involving Chicago politics and crime and, the inner cities, violence in Chicago. It has all these things going for it. It's such a crackerjack cast, with a number of twists and turns. And again, Viola Davis probably going to be nominated. This is Elizabeth Debicki's coming out party. Though she's the one that's going to be, is going to be the standout. I'm pretty certain she's going to get a supporting actress nomination. Again, Brian Tyree Henry can do anything, as far as I'm concerned. Yeah. Colin Farrell, I'm happy he, it continues to be all over the place. He's terrific. This is a film that people are going to discover. I know they will, because it really is that good.
Okay. Comes out in November, and it's called Widows.
Yeah.
All right, cool. All right, what's next?
Well, this is a film that I know you very much want to hear about. It's a film called Her Smell.
Yeah.
Which was always fun when you hear people introducing this film. I'd like to introduce Her Smell to you at the festival. But no, this movie is the latest film from Alex Ross Perry, and he has teamed once again with his Queen of Earth leading lady, Elizabeth Moss. And in the film, she plays what can best be described, I guess, as a Courtney Love-ish type rock star of an all-female rock band. And she's, you know, she's certainly living the life. She is the prototypical bad girl of rock that, you know, she's, you know, it's, you know, she's not great to her bandmates. She has their voodoo ceremonies in the dressing room. She's not good with her manager, the record producer, played by Eric Stoltz in the film, a really nice bit of casting. And it's just, it's unpleasant to watch. At times, it frankly is very unpleasant to watch. But this film, again, is another kind of episodic story. And watching the film, I was struck by whether or not Alex Ross Perry was inspired by what Danny Boyle and Aaron Sorkin did with Steve Jobs. I can't say for certain, but that's, you know, the structure that this movie kind of plays out. That it was, you know, there was three very specific events in Steve Jobs' life. This one, you know, has five, and each one is much more interesting than the next. And again, if this movie had kind of stopped around the 80 or 90 minute mark as it deals with the first three sections of this kind of this spiral, the self-destructive spiral that this character is taking, you might walk away from the film with a kind of a heavy heart, whether or not you really wanted to see that, needed to see it, enjoyed it in any matter, and probably the same way that, you know, the experience of watching Queen of Earth was. But this film goes further than that, and it leads us into what happens after the downward spiral. And you have Elizabeth Moss at the center of this film in what I think is my favorite performance from the festival this year. She is brutally fierce through the first three-fifths of this movie, and then really sad and, you know, again, I don't want to spoil too much
right
where this film is headed, because it's very personal when you watch this movie, and it's suspenseful, it's funny at times, it really, you know, kind of, you know, gets the, you know, who this character is, and what she's going through. And seriously, Nick, I don't think you've ever, probably in your life, ever shed tears to a Bryan Adams song. I promise you, you will during this movie. Mark that down.
All
you
right.
will shed tears during a Bryan Adams song
All
in
right.
this movie.
I will mark that down.
Yeah. This was easily my biggest surprise of the festival. I like Queen of Earth. I don't like it nearly as much as you do.
Yeah.
But this one had so much going for it. This is the movie that I want to share with audiences.
Yeah. I can't wait to see it. You know how I felt about Queen of Earth. You know how much I love Elizabeth mm-hmm. Moss. I think Elizabeth Moss is right now the best actress on the planet. And her work with Perry, that the last movie was just, I thought, amazing. And when I heard about this and I read about it, and then I watched like a little, they have a teaser clip for it. And I was like, I cannot wait to see this thing. So,
mm-hmm.
yeah. All right. So that's Her Smell with Elizabeth Moss. That doesn't have a release date yet, though.
It doesn't have a distributor.
Okay.
No, yeah, we're still waiting to see who picks that thing up, and I'm hoping maybe Magnolia or IFC does.
Yeah. Okay, great. All right, what's next?
I got a couple of very interesting true stories that kind of have a similar arc to both of them. And the first of them is a movie called Driven, and this is a story about John DeLorean. Who is played in the movie by Lee Pace.
Mm-hmm.
People who, you know, when you say DeLorean, you think of one thing, Back to the Future.
Exactly.
Okay. And, you know, this is a story, you know, people who don't know that much about that, you know, this particular piece of history know that it was much more than a car. It was also the subject of a very large drug deal that eventually led to DeLorean's downfall. Now, while Lee Pace plays DeLorean in the film, the movie's central character is actually played by Jason Sudeikis, who is actually a drug runner. He's a pilot, he runs drugs for Michael Cudlitz in the film, and he's just kind of a dopey, Sudeikis-y kind of guy. You know, he kind of wants to be liked. He's fast talking. He's definitely a shady character, but he gets caught at the beginning of the movie and is roped into working with the FBI, played by led by Corey Stoll, and he just happens to move him in next to John DeLorean. And it then, you know, targets, you know, their friendship and how this one lowly drug runner eventually ensnared all these people into this, you know, this deal, seemingly almost without his knowledge, that it just kind of all just kind of, you know, by osmosis, just all kind of all came together because DeLorean is not, you know, that great a guy. And unfortunately, this is not that great a movie either. Yes, I mean, you want to do a story about DeLorean, maybe do the story about John DeLorean and not his neighbor. So it's really unfortunate that there's probably a really interesting story here about who this guy was and why he was so into, you know, getting this really stupid car made. I didn't stick around for the last couple minutes of this movie because I had to run to something else. The story had been told out by then. But up to that point, there's no mention in the film about Back to the Future. Not once. There are references to the car looking like a flying car. I don't know if that's their snarky way of, you know, suggesting what happens at the end of the movie. But, you know, the only reason anyone remembers who DeLorean was is because of Robert Zemeckis.
Right. Okay.
You know.
All right. Well, that's Driven. And how many movies are going to be called Driven?
There's that. There's the Stallone movie.
Right.
The race car movie.
Yeah.
What else is there?
I just remember the Stallone movie because Rennie Harlan directed it. That's the only
one. Of course you did.
okay, so that's Driven and not recommended. By the way, the guy who directed that movie directed Godsend, which is one of the worst movies I've ever seen in my life. And contains,
Nick Hamm.
Yeah, and contains...
I knew that name sounded familiar.
Which contains the worst Robert De Niro performance of all time, which says something.
Yeah. Right,
okay, Eric, hang on. Okay.
Ooh. Yeah.
Hang on. Eric Childress is with us. We'll take another quick break. We come back. More movies from the Toronto Film Festival. Getting exclusive looks here right on WGN. All right. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate Skyline studio here. It's a Monday morning, and that means that my dad's going to call and tell a joke. We did the Monday morning movie reviews, and right now Eric is sticking around. He goes to all the film festivals and reports on them for us, and we've got some more movies to talk about from the Toronto Film Festival as well. And Steve Grzanich will be here at 5 with the opening bell. And at 6, it's Steve Cochran and the Morning Drive. And coming up, the stories that matter with Vic Vaughn from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom on WGN Radio. Right now, though, let's get back to talking with Eric about the Toronto Film Festival movies. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
Okay, where do you want to go next?
Well, I mentioned another true story, and this is actually it's a documentary, and it's called Screwball. And this is the story of the steroid scandal in baseball, specifically centered around Tony Bosch, who is the quote-unquote fake doctor who prescribed and supplied a lot of these illegal drugs to the likes of people like Manny Ramirez and Ryan Braun from the Brewers, and most notably Alex Rodriguez.
Right.
And the story, you know, gives us the entire spectrum of exactly, you know, who Tony Bosch was, how he got involved in this business, and how he eventually attracted the interest of baseball players who found themselves having, you know, a pep in their step after taking his very interesting concoctions and the subsequent lies and denials that eventually came from that. You know, this is a movie with not a lot of good people in it. It's a film, but at the same time, it's, you know, it's more or less framed as a comedy because so many of them are so incompetent and full of their own grandiose, you know, way that they think that they fit them their way into the story. There's a you know, one guy in the movie who basically is, you know, this dope that just wanted to get, get a little extra. He was not a baseball player, not a famous guy at all, but he just heard about Tony Bosch and wanted to, you know, get in better shape, and it just led him to being part of the business and not getting paid back and threatening to blow this story up, and is exactly how it got into the papers. And yet he's, you know, kind of sees himself as this hero, but he's this moron that completely just screws up so many things. And again, you know, this is not a this movie. You know, implicates Major League Baseball in a lot of things. You know, it doesn't make Rob Manfred look like a great guy. Again, it's a very thorough doc, and they do something really funny throughout, is that instead of doing actual recreations of specific events in the film, they actually use children dressed up in bad wigs and and mustaches and mouthing the words of the people of the talking heads telling the story. So you got all these kids, you know, playing these, like, you know, these low-level mobster types and businessmen and whatnot. And it's really this clever thing that they do throughout the film that I had a ball watching every time that one of the kids would show up and reenact these things. From the Billy Corbin, who did the Cocaine Cowboys documentary.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, this is, I mean, clearly he's got a thing for Miami and Florida, because this is another story set in this really horrific part of the world. You know, as there was they say in the movie, as they said on 30 Rock, the penis of America.
That's right.
Yeah. So, Screwball, I highly recommend this documentary. It's a lot of fun.
All right, cool. That sounds great. Okay, we got time for just one more.
One more. Okay, well, let me give you a film that I'm sure that you're also looking forward to. It's the new film from Jeremy Saulnier, and it's called Hold the Dark. Mm-hmm. Jeremy Saulnier, the director of Blue Ruin and Green Room. And this is an adaptation. Macon Blair, the star of Blue Ruin, actually adapted the screenplay for the film. And it's Jeffrey Wright, the great Jeffrey Wright, plays a guy, an author who wrote a book about killing a wolf. And he gets a letter from a woman in Alaska, played by Riley Keough, who writes to him that her son was taken by wolves, that the area that she's living in, this little kind of outpost area that's, partially, you know, it's almost like an Indian reservation, is the string of children are being taken by wolves out in this area. And would he come out to help and track him down, either track down the boy or kill the wolf that took him? So he does come down there and discovers some really peculiar things going on in this this remote area. Alexander Skarsgård plays the husband, Keough's husband, who is off in, I believe, like Afghanistan. He's fighting one of the wars, and he's got some PTSD issues himself. And when he returns to this area, well, things get a whole lot more shakier than you could even imagine. This is a film that has a number of twists and turns. If you've seen Blue Ruin and Green Room, obviously you have. That's the kind of thing you can expect from Saulnier.
Right.
But this one, I believe, is a bit of a misfire. Mm. I'm really sorry to say. It doesn't have that kind of, that really kind of frenetic, suspenseful pace that Green Room had. It doesn't have that sort of that real episodic sense of discovery that Blue Ruin had with its revenge tale. It's got bits and pieces of his previous films and the sort of the themes that he explored in those movies, but it's a really lethargic, slow-moving tale that does have moments of really great carnage in it. There is a shootout sequence that is the centerpiece of this movie that is just horrifically violent. James Badgedale, I should also mention, plays the local sheriff in town. He's in a number of films at Toronto that I saw that, and he was great in every single one of them. Need to see more of that guy. But it leads you on a path, and I'm really sorry to say that Jeffrey Wright, you know, he finally gets a lead role in a movie, and he feels so inconsequential throughout this entire movie. It just feels like there's you know, and it pains me to say this, but it's like watching an old man kind of dodder around, you know, an area that we know he's not up for the challenge for. We know that he's not, you know, he's probably not going to be the hero of the story. And it's just, it's painful to watch. It kind of made me wish that his character was moved into James Badge Dale's character, and then we'd have a little bit more of a what's going to happen, because we really just don't have the sense that anything is going to turn out, you know, in any positive way in this story, which is not always a bad thing, but it's just so lethargic, and it doesn't really seem like it earns the kind of carnage that it has throughout.
Right.
So I think this is a real misfire from Saulnier.
It's too bad, and it's going to be on Netflix at the end of the month. So
yeah.
Okay, that's Hold the Dark. All right, Eric, thanks so much, man. I really appreciate it. We will talk to you next week.
Absolutely.
Okay,
thank you.
Eric Childress, everybody. All right, we'll take a break here for the news on 720 WGN.